Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 202 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. It's a little bit later. We had an interview that we recorded, so we're a little bit later. How are you tonight?
Awesome. Let's get going.
Yeah, we should dive right in. Tell us what we have going on, and not time travel because we already recorded an interview, but what else do we have going on?
We have several questions that have come to us by various mechanisms that we receive questions here at FYP Education. And we have a news article from Tennessee that we're going to try to cover. And we have our Name That Speaker.
Beautiful. All right. Well, then we will just dive the frickety frack right on in. And we will jump on over to the first question of the evening. It says, I have a friend that has just been released from incarceration and is currently on PFR probation, has been for a couple months. He is starting a job as a truck driver and is going to be using an e-log system. And I guess that's electronic driving log system to track miles and times for truck drivers. I think that is very much accurate. But in order to use it, he needs internet access to upload his logs. When he asked the treatment counselor, he was told that he had to be in treatment for a minimum of 6 months before she would even consider thinking about it. But when he asked his probation officer, she told him that he would have a judge amend his probation. He then told his PO that he would like to get a different treatment provider. His PO told him again that he would have to get a judge to approve that as well. I wasn't aware that this was the case, as I have not seen anything like that in Florida statutes. Is there something I am missing? Larry, look, I'm just going to tell you, as a tech person, having some sort of digital device thingamajigger that's in the cab that lets you press the button that says I'm driving, I'm not driving, is not the same as saying I have internet access. That's somebody that's really passing the buck.
Well, I'm taking the question at face value, said they have to have internet access. But I see a merging of two issues that are unrelated in this question. I would not jump to the conclusion that you need a new treatment provider. I don't see that connection. What the probation officer said is to get a judge to order it. Why would that translate to needing another treatment provider? Of course, I know the answer to what is, like, I don't like the fact this treatment provider said I won't consider it for 6 months. That means that this treatment provider is not going to be fair to me, which means I need a new treatment provider. That's what he's thinking. But I would not jump to that conclusion. I would merely go to the judge and do it to the PO. The PO is not likely to violate you for going to the judge when they've told you to go to the judge. That's a long shot there. So I would go to the, if internet access is needed for this e-log system, which that's not in my wheelhouse, go to the judge and ask for that. Do not ask the judge to give you a new treatment provider. That will upset the apple cart like you have never believed. It's like going to the polygraph office with your lawyer in hand and saying, I'm here to take the polygraph. Do not do that.
What about having a polygraph in your house when they come shake you down?
That's even worse if you do that. I think we learned the consequences for that.
We may have learned those consequences. I'm sorry, my friend, for saying that. I'm sorry. I'm just poking fun at you.
But yes, this is, there are two unrelated issues. You make your compelling case to the judge that you need internet access for employment. It's more likely than not, I would speculate, unless the crime had a direct tie to the internet and there's a justifiable reason to totally ban or severely restrict. I would just about bet that access would be granted for employment. But here's the part that they didn't raise in the question, that I'll go ahead and raise it. Are we talking about interstate driving here?
Or just within? God, I would think that even local drivers, Larry, probably have like the driver log thing. Because if you're in a state like Georgia or New Mexico, you could drive all day cross state and you are going to run into the limits of the 8 hours or 10 hour limit, whatever it is. Someone correct me. But somewhere in that ballpark.
That's not where I'm headed with this. If you're going to be on supervision as a person forced to register, driving interstate trucking is not going to be an easy task. I'm not saying it's impossible. Some jurisdictions may be more tolerant to try to make that happen. But if you try to do that job in New Mexico, they would laugh at you and tell you to go find another job. And I'm not...
Because they're not going to let you just randomly leave the state and go to the next 10 states that are in your proximity.
That is correct. They're going to tell you that you needed a travel permit, and by interstate compact, they're not allowed to do that. They have to let the other state know that there's going to be a PFR in the territory. And I'm sure we'll get some emails saying, I drove a truck. I'm not even contesting that. Right. I'm telling you that my state would never allow you to do that. I don't know what Florida's position is going to be if he's going to be driving out of state, but that's something to consider as well. Will they allow him to have this job? There are jobs that people can be restricted from doing if they make the impose the restriction as a reasonable related to the offense. For example, I don't know what the level of adult bookstores exist in Georgia. They don't exist across the country the way they once did because of the internet, but they do have adult stores that sell toys and some degree of sexually stimulating stuff.
What kind of toys, Larry?
They would never allow you to work at a sexual toy store while you're under PFR supervision. That would be a reasonable prohibition on your employment opportunities. And it wouldn't matter that you said you worked at that store for 7 years before you got convicted. They're not going to let you do it. So it may not be appropriate for him to drive a truck, depending on what he did and how he did his offense.
I completely understand. I was just kind of poking at you on that one because that was funny. I wanted to hear you describe what adult toy stores were. Okay. I think that is everything there. Shall we move on then, sir?
Let's do number two.
Number two, then. It says, Dear Narsal. I changed the order just a hair off of what was written down there. It says, I know from personal experience as well as anecdotal evidence of others that fighting a sex crime charge is probably one of the hardest cases to make. Most lawyers will tell you that there is no defense and they urge defendants to take a plea, any plea. And then it continues. So my question is, what are the best defense strategies for someone accused of a PFR type offense? Generally, just generally, as I know a large multitude of factors will affect any individual case, are there available statistics on the rate of conviction ratio of plea or to trial for PFR type charges? Interesting question, actually.
I don't know about those particularized statistics, but overwhelming majority, 90%+. Plead guilty. I would say in the sexual arena, it's even higher than that already astoundingly high number. But what are the defenses? It's really specific to the allegations of the complaint of what was alleged, what type of PFR case we have. If you're talking about a porn possession charge, we're going to be more interested in terms of what's being depicted in the porn. And the age of, it's very important that it's not illegal if the person's not underage. So we sometimes get into disputes about the age of what's being shown. Sometimes there's no doubt. I mean, if you look at a 9-year-old doesn't pass for an 18-year-old very often. But a 15, 16-year-old very well pass for 18. So we get into trying to prove that depiction is an image of a person who's underage and cannot lawfully pose for that photograph. So, but if it was a forcible offense, we're going to be looking more at evidence that would suggest that the force happened. So we're going to be looking at the sexual assault nurse examiner, the same nurse, or what the report says, what was alleged to have happened, that we're going to be looking for evidence of force. Because at the very minimum, we're going to try to cut it down to being consensual. I mean, that's just what we do in this business. We don't go in and say, yep, state, you made a valid charge here. We're going to plead the person guilty. You look for defenses. That's your job. That's why it's called a defense attorney. So we're going to be looking for ways to mitigate the harm that's being done. The defenses can be diminished by your confession that you made when they read you your rights and told you that you had the right to remain silent. That would have been a good point to have stopped, but most don't. So, and then if we're looking at an offense where the person, it was merely criminal because of the age, then as an attorney, we're going to look at, do they have to prove this mistake of age and offense? Oftentimes it's not, but we'll look for that. And any representations that's been made in terms of age by the accusing party, we're going to be looking, can we prove that there was misrepresentation? Because we're going to try to do mitigation. But in terms of defenses, it's going to be variable to what the allegations were specific to each person as to what defenses are best asserted. But the victims industrial complex and the law enforcement complex have worked vigorously over the last 20 years to diminish our defenses. You know, we can't aggressively cross-examine because that's victimizing them the second time. We can't introduce any sexual history because that's not relevant to the instant accusation. It doesn't matter about that stuff. So we have a lot of things we cannot do. And remember, give your defense attorney a little bit of slack. They didn't make the law. They're just simply opening up the statute book and blowing the dust off of it and looking at what the elements are that have to be proved. They're looking at what the criminal complaint alleges. They're looking at your statement. They're looking at the video of you confessing. They're looking at all those things. And oftentimes that weighs very heavily in terms of negotiating a plea. Because without a plea, guess what? Your sentencing options are wide open. If you don't do a plea, you do the plea to contain the range of sentencing. So if you have five counts and the state agrees to drop three of the counts, you've just diminished the range of punishment by a significant amount. And then if you negotiate even further, that the sentence will be no more than maybe of those two remaining counts, they could stack those and give you 10 years on each one. You may negotiate that those will run concurrently. That's not something that you could achieve in a trial because that would be the option of running those convictions consecutive. So you may have a plea that says, I will give the person, in exchange for the plea, a guarantee of no more than 8 years max. Isn't that a whole lot better than 20 years stacked or 50 years stacked if you had all five counts and the jury convicted them? That's the reason why we do pleas, folks, because you're looking for certainty of outcome versus the uncertainty of the outcome.
Well, now I'm going to make your head explode. But Larry, we should all stop taking pleas and then we would blow up the criminal system, the court system, and then they would have to start lowering the requirements of everything.
That's an interesting theory, but there's only one problem with that theory. The defense attorney has a job to represent the best interest of that particular client. You will not find anywhere in the rules of professional conduct where your job is to try to blow the system up so you can redesign the system. So your job is to look at your case specific, your client specific, and try to come up with the best outcome in view of the circumstances that exist for your client. So that's never going to happen. You can wish, and you can wish, and you can wish, but that is never going to happen. And I just told you that, so there'll be a lot of ugly emails I'll get this week. But Larry, you just don't understand. If everybody would stand together, stick together, it would work. But it won't work because it's never going to happen.
I gotcha. All right, well then let's go over to question number three. It says, first of all, tell you gentlemen how much of a lifeline your podcast has been for me. Often I find myself feeling very alone and needed to listen to you guys. Just remember that I am not walking this walk all by myself. As soon as I am no longer a full-time nursing student, I will become a patron. In the meantime, I will wait my turn to hear your humor and insight. But however, thank you very much. Seriously, this is my own commentary. Thank you very much for becoming a patron. If you're waiting, then you somehow got off of being a nursing student. My situation here is much like many others. My husband and I have resided in our home in Florida since 1998. In 2018, he was arrested on 10 counts of CP. 10 is some sort of magic number for felonies of this type in Florida. We fought it as hard as we could without putting our house on the line to keep him out of prison, but the DA would not allow anything that didn't include state prison time. So as of December 2020, he has been in prison, and we expect with good time, I think is what was supposed to be there, he will be released in June of 2023. He will be on PFR probation for 5 years after his release. And this is Florida, Larry, right? So that means forever. SO probation will be difficult enough, but our main concern is housing. Our county ordinances state PFRs cannot live within 2,500 feet of a school, daycare, playground, pretty much all of humanity. Our home is well within a 2,500-foot radius of a few schools. Yes, multiple schools, public, private, and charter. The closest schools were built around us since we've lived in and owned the home, but of course, prior to his arrest. The million-dollar question is, will he be able to come home? Has he essentially given up his residence status in our house by being in prison? Is there legal precedence regarding this type of scenario? And who or what state entity decides this or approves residences? Thank you for putting your time and effort into such a great podcast and source of information to support the PFRs and families. I appreciate all that you do. Keep us in the know. Sincerely, Liz and FYP. Thank you for signing it, FYP, Liz. That was really very clever of you. And wow, thank you for becoming a patron also. Larry, go at it.
Now, is this the $1,400 monthly one?
Yes, absolutely. Came in right at the stimulus check money. And then also added on the child tax credit, too.
Because, you know, this podcast is all about the money, right?
It's all about the money, every second of it, Larry.
So, well, there are a lot of questions buried in here, and I don't know the answer. What I would tell you how to go about getting the answer, though, what we're probably talking about Miami-Dade County, because that's the county I'm familiar with for those that don't know. That's in the southern tip of Florida, and they have the 2,500 foot rule. So I'm guessing that's what we're talking about. But there's a lot of unknowns here. We don't know if within the county ordinance, if there is a grandfather clause in the ordinance. So we would need to have the ordinance. This came to me like an hour before we went live. So I don't know that I had enough time to even begin to look. But we would need to know if there's a grandfather for people who lived there prior to that. But then what we'd also need to know, does the stint in prison break the residence? Because technically he's not residing there at the moment. We don't know if his residence has been forfeited by his residence in the Florida Department of Corrections. So we don't know that. But then we can get to what we do know. We know that there is a restriction that may apply to him. And we also know that the probation authorities have the ability, if they so choose, to impose restrictions retroactively. So what I wish we had here was some information from the attorney, if there was even any discussion about this, because the attorney knew, I'm assuming if you get to know your clients, which most of the people who are good at this, we do. We want to know for several reasons for stuff like situations like this. And we also want to know because it helps us to figure out if you can pay the bill. And most of the attorneys, when they do small talk, they're coming at it for wanting to know if you can pay the fee. But I also want to know if we can help protect you. So knowing where you live, particularly on a PRFR offense in a state that has hopscotching all over the state, there's a 1,000-foot requirement in state statute, and it doesn't apply to every single PFR. But then the jurisdictions are free to impose their own, and it can vary from that 1,000 up to 2,500 in Miami-Dade, and maybe there are other counties who have that. So we would need to figure out if the attorney did anything in the plea negotiation process to deal with the issue of housing. Did he even care, he or she care, about that issue? When the client pays you big money, and I can assure you they paid big money for this, it's your duty to try to help mitigate the damage on the backside. The prison is only temporary. What, 3 years if he gets all his good time? So you need to look beyond that. So I'd like to know what the attorney discussed in terms of housing, if anything. And if the attorney didn't say anything and that attorney practices in this county and they didn't do that, I'm really dubious about the competency level, as was pointed out in the pre-recorded episode that we did. The attorney may be an attorney, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're a good attorney.
Yeah, sure.
But what I would do if I were her, I would start with the Florida Action Committee. And they may or may not respond. These are volunteers, which they are affiliate of NARSOL, which I'm on the board of directors of NARSOL. I would contact them and see if they have any insight about if there's a grandfather provision. If they don't know, or if they don't respond, then I would say that we could probably make a couple of attorney referrals off air to this patron in terms of who they might contact to get some reliable information. But he may in fact be precluded from coming back to the house. I just don't know. That would be tragic.
And this is not going to help any, but a friend of mine here that I met while I was gone, when he moved back home, there had been a pool put in since they had moved in. So it came in their neighborhood afterwards, and he was grandfathered. Now, I know that that's a one-off example in a different state, different conviction, all that stuff. So I'm like, it may be possible. I'm only saying that for that reason, that maybe there's some sort of grace out there that would let you stay there since you, I think the way you stated it, that they lived there before all the other things moved in, I think.
Yep. So we'll have to wait and see. And then, of course, she can feel free to provide us additional details.
Very good. And then moving along, I think this is, so this is a 4RM202 public something or another. It says, state's sex offender registry faces questions. This is from Tennessee lawmakers. I'm assuming that this is a newspaper article, Larry. This is actually like a printed actual, what, the Tennessean? Oh, that's the newspaper. And here are some highlighted blocks that I got to read. The concern is the state's system, established in 1994 and revamped in 2004, may now be deemed unconstitutional for being too punitive, lawmakers said. What we don't want in Tennessee is for our registry to be struck down and we wake up tomorrow morning and there are roughly 20,000 current PFRs on the registry that we've got no good way to keep up with, said Representative Mike Bell, Republican of Riceville, who co-chairs the joint committee. Did I add enough dramatic inflection there, Larry?
You did a great job.
All right. Then it continues. Davis recommended lawmakers look at model legislation produced by the American Law Institute, a Philadelphia-based advocacy group consisting of judges, lawyers, and legal experts. The legislature should also allow trial courts more discretion in determining how long and whether an offender should remain on the registry. But the solution, in a room full of conservative lawmakers with a tough-on-crime stance, is unlikely going to be abolishing the system. Bell said he could look at establishing a board to assess individual offenders' risk to public safety. House Criminal Justice Committee Chairman Michael Curio, Republican of Dixon, said the legislature realizes the system should be changed. The change isn't to weaken the system, he said, but to fix the legal problems. Nobody is saying that we need to be soft on PFRs, he said. What we are saying is what we are doing is not workable. We need to fix that. Where are you going with this craziness, Larry?
I put it in here because we've got some listeners in Tennessee and they keep reminding us that they're in the Sixth Circuit, which we're cognizant of that fact. This Davis person is a defense attorney who's from the Tennessee Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, and he's trying to point the legislature toward the prestigious group called the American Law Institute, a Philadelphia-based. Now, I can tell you as a Southerner, you come in and start talking about Philadelphia. They have no interest in hearing what anything from Philadelphia has. I mean, that's the last place they'd look for advice. But the main thing I put in here for is, folks, the Tennessee legislature is under Republican control. And you hear that because you hear the committee chairs. That means they have the majority. So don't waste your time going to the Democrat Party, because they can't do anything for you other than be sympathetic. You need to go to the party who's in the majority, to these key people. And if you want registry reform, that's who you need to talk to. This is just, I put in here for a snippet of hearing what lawmakers are likely to say when you go talk to them. They've already told you that they're not interested in letting PFRs go. They're interested in doing the least they have to do to save the status quo. That's what they said here. And this is from the Tennessean newspaper. It was sent to us by a listener. And so I told him eventually we would talk about it. We've had it a couple of weeks. So now we've talked about it. It's not likely that this is going to result in any major changes. The only way change is going to come to Tennessee is you start electing different people, which is not likely, or the courts collar them like they did in Michigan, and they're finally forced to make some token reforms. But the registry is not going to come crashing down, and there's the rest of my hate mail coming.
You are trying to run off all of our listeners, Larry.
I'm doing a good job, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely, especially with the numbers that we've seen lately. Yeah, okay. So you don't think that I think this is stemming from the high court, not the high court, but the appeals level court, is that right? I always get these wrong.
The Sixth Circuit Court that's the federal
court. And that's
court
from
appeals.
The Michigan case, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And so since they're in the same district, like they have to follow the rules of what they said in that little quadrant, correct?
Yes, there are dozens of cases pending in Tennessee and federal court, and there's eventually going to be decisions that are going to force the lawmakers' hands. But they have just told you that they're going to do the least that they can do. If you listen to them and trust what they said, that might encourage you to vote for different people.
and that could be people of the same party, but just different ones, perhaps, Larry?
Well,
I was trying to throw a bone out there for something, but you can do it that how you want.
Well, this party is the party who actually needs to do it, because they will vilify the other party if they try. But see, the other party's not going to try because they're in such a minority in Tennessee, they couldn't pass anything if they wanted to. So why would they stick their neck out on something like this when they can't pass anything? So this is actually the party, as long as they're the majority, you need to be talking to. So make your journeys to the people that represent you and tell them this, that this is a real problem, and see what they tell you. And remind them that you're a constituent if you are.
Is it going to sound like go pound sand?
It's not going to be good.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Joining us now is Brandon Thomas, and Mr. Thomas operates the law office of Brandon A. Thomas, located in Atlanta, Georgia. The firm specializes in criminal law cases, including PFR petitions and failure to register offenses. Mr. Thomas received his law degree from Emory University of Law. He also received his bachelor's degree cum laude in political science from the State University of Chicago at Albany, and that's SUNY. Mr. Thomas is a former assistant federal defender for the Middle District of Alabama, and that's in Montgomery area. As a federal defender, Mr. Thomas handled serious felony cases ranging from white-collar crime to drug and firearm cases where defendants were facing life sentences. Prior to this, he was an assistant public defender for the Eastern Judicial Circuit of Georgia, and that's near Savannah, where he exclusively handled felony cases and served as lead attorney on jury trials. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Thomas. How are you tonight?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate you coming on a kind of short notice, but you joined us at the Atlanta conference. I think that was in 2015, and that's where we first met. But I'm sure you don't remember me for all of that, because that was a long time ago.
No, I do. It wasn't that long ago. I want to say 3 years, 4 years, maybe.
Larry, remind me, when was the first Atlanta conference?
I think we did 15 and 16 in Atlanta, but or I'm about sure, though. It may have been 16 and 17, but we did two in Atlanta back-to-back.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you were at the first one. So anyway, whatever. So you are a defense attorney in Atlanta, Georgia, and the majority of your career has been criminal defense. Can you tell the audience what attracted you to this area of law?
I'm always like criminal. I actually do, at this point in my career, I do pretty much half criminal, half employment. But the bulk of my career prior to having my own practice was criminal. So it's something I've always liked. I watched all the Law and Order episodes growing up and all the Matlock, and maybe internalized some of that. So it's never boring. There's always something new in criminal law. It's someone's real life. So that keeps it interesting as well. People facing significant amounts of time. Here in Georgia, we have pretty lengthy sentences based on these statutes. So there's a lot to lose. So I think I like that excitement aspect of it. It's something I enjoy, and it's good work. And we don't run out of crime in Atlanta, tell you what, we really don't. So there's always something to do.
Yeah, I can only imagine that you never run out of anything to do. Specifically, the reason why we are having you on is because we are going to be talking about the removal process for the PFR types. And PFR, if you're not familiar with the acronym, is person forced to register. We try not to use terms like sex offender and whatnot. So we use PFR, person forced to register. And that code for the Georgia side of things is OCGA, and that's 42-1-19. And let me begin by asking first, are there certain offenses that are not eligible to be removed from the registry?
There's a lot of offenses that are not eligible. like we were discussing before, the one of the reasons that I have like a very high percentage of success, like 90% of the people I represent are able to get off the registry. And the reason that for that is I pretty much cherry pick my cases, because like I can look at a case and get a very good idea about whether somebody's going to be able to get off the registry or not. And so right off the top, rape is not going to work. 100% you're not getting off the registry in Georgia with the and if it's literal rape, like an actual rape first degree, there's no way, because it's written into the law that certain offenses you cannot get off the registry. For example, if you have a conviction that led to physical harm to the victim, you can't get off the registry. And so rape implies sexual contact by force. And so that by definition, that implies physical harm. And so for that reason, you're not gonna be able to get off. If the victim was restrained in any way, like let's say they got tied up with like a rope or anything like that, or even depending on the facts, if sometimes there's such a thing as you can incapacitate someone using like drugs. Like let's say they gave somebody Rohypnol or some type of drug that like knocked them out and then they had sex with them. That can also be a bar for you getting off the registry. Multiple transactions, that's another problem. So like, let's say somebody commits a sex offense and then they commit another sex offense. So have the fact that you have more than one will operate as a bar in Georgia. So every state has their own law. That's what's important to know. And so, I'm in Georgia and I practice in Georgia, all over Georgia, but my expertise is limited to Georgia. And so you could be in Montana or something and you have a completely different law. And maybe you can get off the registry in Montana with a rape conviction. But I just know what you can do here in Georgia. And to some extent, I'm familiar with Alabama just because I get a lot of Alabama calls just because we're right next to Alabama. But other than that, you really need to consult a lawyer in your state so they can tell you what the requirements are in your state.
Under OCGA 42-1-19A provides some of the opportunity to file a petition even before the passage of 10 years. Can you shed go into that a little bit on this subsection?
So pretty much anyone who's been, let me back up. In Georgia, again, everybody has their own system, but in Georgia, everyone's going to be level 1, 2, or 3, and you get that level from the Sex Offender Review Board. So in Georgia, level 1 is the lowest, level 3 is the highest. That's called sexually dangerous predator. So if you're level 1, you're eligible to be removed from the registry as soon as you completed your sentence. And completing your sentence means there's no incarceration left, there's no probation or parole left. So if you still, what happens to a lot of people is they may, like, let's say they got, I've seen before somebody commit a sex offense and they got a 30 served 10, which means they got 10 years in prison, 20 years probation. So even though they're out of prison, they're not eligible to be removed from the registry because they still have the 20-year probation. So what would have to happen is they'd have to file a motion for early termination and get that 20 years cut to something less. Typically, you're going to have to do at least half the time. So like, let's say you have 20 years on probation left, you have to do at least 10 years, don't get in any trouble, then you can ask the court to cut your probation sentence, and I've had success with that. You can do that. Then after that, you can try to get off the registry, but you can't get off the registry until your sentence is over.
I can attest to that one being true. I just did that roughly a year ago. I've heard that a person has to be leveled prior to getting the court to consider the petition. What does this mean, and how does a person go about getting leveled? Do I like just pick up the phone and go, hey, review board, I need you to do me a favor and can you level me? Or is there something more of a formal process that needs to be done?
So typically there's two ways for that to happen. The first way is if you go to prison. And if you go to prison in Georgia, very often before you're released, the Sex Offender Review Board is going to conduct what's called a risk assessment. And then they're going to give you level 1, 2, or 3. And they're going to give you a narrative telling you why they put you at that level. So The more serious the offense, the more likely your level is to be high. But they also look at different factors, such as, for example, multiple transactions. If you have multiple instances of child molestation, for example, that's more likely to place you a level 2 or level 3. Certain offenses aren't as serious as other offenses, even though they're all sex offenses. So, for example, rape, first degree, would be like the most serious offense. Statutory rape, in my opinion, is probably the least serious because it implies consent that, you know, they didn't force themselves on the other person. It's just that as a legal matter, the other person was not of an age where they could have consented to the sexual contact. So those cases, more likely are gonna be level 1, whereas a more serious offense is more likely to be level 2 or 3.
Okay.
And so so to answer your question, the first way to get off the registry is if you go to prison. A lot of people don't go to prison, and sometimes you even go to prison, they still don't give you a level. The other way to get the level is that you file a petition to be removed from the registry, and then the Sex Offender Review Board will give you a level before the court makes a determination about whether to let you off the registry or not.
When you do that process with the filing, the motion, how long do they have some kind of time limit to respond to that kind of petition?
They have 90 days for the risk assessment by law, but I've had it happen before where sometimes they come back faster. I've had them come back as fast as 45 days. And I've also had situations where it took much longer than 90 days and they just asked for special permission. Basically, they just told the court, look, we need more time. And then it ends up, I've seen it take as long as 3 months before.
Interesting.
Excuse me, not 3 months. 90 days is 3 months. I guess 3 months longer than that. So I've seen it take like 6 months before.
And some people's
convictions are really old. So it's like, so let me back up. The Sex Offender Review Board, this is what they're doing. They're trying to get police reports. They want to see the guilty plea transcript. They want to look at the indictment. There's a lot of documents they want to look at to try to figure out, okay, should this person be level 1, 2, or 3? And the problem is like some people's conviction is so old, like right now, like I say, like since year 2000 or so, criminal law has become very computerized and like everything is scanned in nice and neat on a computer. But if your conviction is like for 1980 or something, a lot of times they got to like pull it up off like a microfilm. Or they have to like literally like blow the dust off the archive, like it's in an old dusty box somewhere in the back and they have to dig it out. And that can take time. And sometimes even when they dig through all the boxes, they still can't find it. So that's the problem. And so I've had that happen before. Like I had a client who was 70 years old trying to get off the registry and his conviction was, I want to say it was like from the 80s, and they really were having, and then on top of that, like the more rural the county, the more it's likely it is that they're not technologically advanced. So like if you're in a major city like Atlanta or Nashville, Los Angeles, they probably have their archives pretty well put together. But like that particular case that I'm thinking about, he was like in a rural place in Tennessee when he got conviction.
Sure.
So they are a lot slower to get things like computerized and scanned in and stuff. So they really have to look for it.
I completely understand that. So we just covered how does the person file the petition and where, and then, but where, like which county does this happen in? Does it happen in, And I guess then to extend that question one step further, does it matter if they're from out of state by chance?
Well, see, again, here's the problem. Like every state is going to have its own procedure. And so I can only speak to Georgia. And the way Georgia does things is if your conviction is from Georgia, you file the petition in the county that you got convicted in. If your conviction was not from Georgia, you need to file the petition in the county that you reside in. So I have a lot of clients who like they got convicted in Ohio or California or something, and we just filed the petition wherever they live. So, but if your conviction is from like, Macon County or something, it has to be filed in Macon County. There's no way around it. But that's how Georgia works. Other states, what I find is that most states have similar laws in terms of, like, half the states have a way for you to get at the registry and half do not. And the ones that do have a way for you to get at the registry, I feel like they largely, like, borrow from each other in terms of the law and the structure and how to get off the registry. But that doesn't mean it's the same procedure at all. Like, it can definitely vary. So what I'm talking about is very specific to Georgia. If you're in New Mexico, it may not go like this at all.
Yeah, we talk about this pretty frequently on the podcast, that they are similar, just like you described, but every state has their own nuances. And Larry, do you want to add anything in there for that?
Sure, Brandon, he's got it pretty accurate. Significant number of the states do not have a process at all. But of the states that do, there are a fair amount that have similar characteristics. In Arkansas, you'd file in the county where you were convicted. And all the states, that North Carolina, you file in the county where you were convicted. And the same process applies for the out-of-staters. You file in the county you live. That would almost seem, Brandon, like that might present an opportunity for a little bit of form shopping. If a person had the resources to could pick their county, if they did their research carefully enough, they could say, "Huh, well, 90% get off in Fulton County and 30% get off in Sumter County. I think I'll live in Fulton County."
That would be.
I was just gonna go there.
That would be better, but that's not typically how life works. Like, it's just not like it. Like, I have a client right now who is a woman, and she is in a rural county in Georgia. And I was asking her, I was like, I'm just curious, you're not criticizing, and they're just curious, well, why did you move there? Like, it's probably as conservative as you can possibly get. And I'm just curious why somebody would move there on purpose, knowing that they have a sex offense and she's married. And she's like, well, my husband got a job here and that's why we came. And I said, okay. Sex offenders get a hard time everywhere, but she's in a particularly, it's a lot less tolerant, I would say, to sex offenders than other places. But she went where they could make a living because her husband has a job. And it's like, okay, so the petition has to get filed where she lives. And so we just got to deal with it. But in hindsight, if you really want to get up the registry, if that's your number one priority, maybe you should move to Fulton County where things are a little more balanced. But people have to live. Especially you got kids, you have responsibilities, you have to go where the employment is, and that's where her employment is. Like,
yeah, I'm with you.
It's going to be hard to just sleep on a street corner in Fulton County just for the purposes of getting off the registry. Like, if you don't have a job, like, what are you supposed to do?
Totally. We had a person with a situation that we covered, and he was trying to move to, like, the most rural part down in the southeast part of the state, and they kept pulling the rug out from underneath him. And this wasn't to get off the registry, but this was just registry conditions in general. He's coming from New York, and it was just a nightmare. Like, why did you pick to go there? You could have picked kind of sort of anywhere in the state to go, but he chose to go pick to, like, one of the toughest areas with no population, and they're just going to be all up your hiney trying to make a point that we don't want your kind here.
Basically, yeah, to me, they do that on purpose to kind of chase people away.
Totally, totally. When you do go to court, though, how do you prove, like, who has the burden of proof? I mean, I'm going to come up with, like, a non-legal scenario, but, like, how do I say that I'm not going to be a threat to society? So who presents, you're presenting my case saying, no, Your Honor, we have evidence that this guy's not going to, because we went to the future to try and predict. But so how do you prove that I'm not going to be a threat, that I deserve to be off the registry at this point?
Okay, so the short answer is the person seeking to get off the registry has the burden of proof. And there's a few things there. The first is, if you come back level one, that's the Sex Offender Review Board determining that you're the lowest risk level. So that speaks for itself. So that's a feather in your cap right there. Just by itself, you're level one. And I've had that before be influential to the court. where, you know, so let me back up. This process, like my job is to argue for the sex offender to get off the registry, and the prosecution's job is to argue for them to stay on the registry. That's just their job. Like, and sure. I always tell my clients, don't take it personally. That's just their job. Just like if it was an actual pending criminal case, my job is to get you out of jail and their job is to keep you in jail. And that's just what it is. So when we go to court, the prosecution is doing everything they can to argue that this person shouldn't be released from the registry, the danger to society, et cetera. So the very first thing is, if they're level one, it's like, Your Honor, the Sex Offender Review Board are experts in determining risk. They know how to discern between someone who's a low risk, who's an intermediate risk level two, and who's a high level risk level three. They said that my client is level one. That's the first thing. Second, would be length of time since the offense. So the ideal situation is something like, which I have a lot, like let's say their offense was like from 20 years ago. So we're trying to predict the future, and basically the court's trying to figure out, okay, if I let this guy off the registry, is he gonna be like kidnapping little kids and throwing them into the van and doing all this stuff? Or is it gonna be okay? That's what he's trying to figure out. Like no judge wants to be the judge that lets somebody off the registry and then the sex offender went out and did something crazy. And now they put the judge on the news and the judge looks crazy. Like, why did him off the registry? Didn't you know he did this 20 years ago? That's the problem with society, judges like this. And so nobody wants to be the judge that's on the hook for that. So that's really what the whole thing is about. The judge is trying to see, do I trust this person or not, to not make me look crazy? And one of the biggest things, like I said, after you get beyond the level of the person is the length of time that they've gone without being a recidivist. So if their offense was like from the year 2000 and it's now 2021, that's 21 years they haven't done a sex offense. It's like, Your Honor, they haven't done anything in 21 years. I think the risk that you, if you let them off the registry, they're going to go out and do something crazy is very low. So a trickier situation is, which I've had before, where let's say somebody gets a relatively short sentence. Let's say somebody gets like, let's say they got 5 years in prison, no probation, okay? So their offense was committed in, let's say their offense was committed 2016 and it's now 2021. They just got out of prison. The Sex Offender Review Board has found them to be level one. So they're eligible to be removed right away. I have people contact me all the time who they just finished a sentence and they are eligible to be removed from the registry. And I've gotten people like that removed from the registry before, but to me, that's a tougher thing. It's much tougher than somebody who it's been like 20, 30 years and they haven't done anything. Because that puts the prosecutor in a position where they kind of have to make somewhat ridiculous arguments to argue that the person is a risk when it's like they haven't done anything in 20, 30 years. Like, why are you even saying that? Whereas somebody who just got out of prison, you really don't have much of a track record to base anything off of because they just got out. They haven't had an opportunity to do a sex offense. You don't know one way or another. A third thing that's been very effective is people being married, marital status. I've had a lot of success with that. I've had cases where I felt like the court was on the fence about, should I let this person out the registry? Should I not? Should I do it? Should I not? And the wife coming to court and just talking about that this man is a good man and that's why I married him. I knew he was a sex offender and I married him anyway. That just somebody like being married to you, like that's the biggest like cosign that you can get. They're vouching for that person. It's like, I wouldn't be married to this person if I didn't think they were a good person. And furthermore, I think there's just there's somewhat of a bias which works in the sex offender's favor. It's a good thing and I use it to our advantage. People think that if you're married, basically like your wife is checking up on you and you're less likely to commit a sex offense. So that's just what they think. And so we just go with it. So it's like the court thinks you're less likely to do something crazy because you're married. So that's been very effective. And then following that, maybe some people have really good jobs. That helps sometimes. But it's really the first three things. Level one, ideally a long time since the offense occurred, like, you know, 20 years or something, ideally in the ideal world. And third, if they're married, they have a stable life, that's better than you being single. The worst case scenario, let me just to illustrate, the worst case scenario is like a single person who's not married. They just got out of prison, and so they haven't even been out that long, so they don't have a track record of not being a recidivist. And then let's say they're homeless or something, compared to someone who's married, has a stable house, maybe even a homeowner sometimes, and they have a good job. So just to show you those two extremes, like the latter situation is where I said, judge, he has everything together, he's doing great. We asked to be released, he's not a risk. And like I said, 90% of my people get off the registry, but that's just because I cherry pick things. If I think something's gonna be a problem, I tell people in advance, I don't think this is gonna work.
I gotcha. How about somebody filing on their own? I guess that's called pro se, I think. Does that term apply in this context as well? Do you recommend that people file this on their own, or do you recommend that they hire an attorney?
I do not recommend it, but I mean, I mean.
This is another conversation that we have. Like, you are allowed to, though, correct? Like, I can go, hey, judge, I would like to petition to get off the registry. Like, I'm allowed to do that?
Yes, but
I can also go change my own oil in my car too, but I might not know how to. Is that where we're going to go?
I mean, I think I saw a movie once where like somebody got like, you know, attacked with a sword and then they did their own surgery and sold themselves off. I think I saw it in them. But for the most part, I mean, I used to work when I was in Savannah being a public defender, like, sometimes you would have defendants who wanted to represent themselves and the judge would just be like, look, I mean, you can try to pull out your own teeth if you want to, but it's probably going to be a lot less painful if you go to the dentist. Like, they know how to do that. It's a serious thing, but it's a complicated thing because as a class, sex offenders very generally, they don't have money because it's like, it's already hard enough to get a job when you're a convicted felon. It's like times 10 if you're a registered sex offender. So now it's like, okay, it's easy to say go out and hire a lawyer, but you can have somebody who's either A, they're homeless, they don't have a job, so there's no way for them to do that, or B, maybe they have a job, but they really just have enough income to survive and they don't have money to pay an attorney. So all they can do is file it by themselves. But what I would tell you is that even lawyers who are like practicing attorneys that do criminal law, if they had to try to jump in and do these registry petitions, they'd be lost. And I've seen people do it before, unfortunately. I've seen people just file these petitions and they look like a mess, like lawyers even. And that's because, I mean, some lawyers, they'll just tell you straight up, they're like, look, this is not my expertise. This is not in my wheelhouse. I'm not going to represent you on this. And the reality is, though, lawyers with law practices, like, they have bills, too, just like regular people. And some lawyers will take someone's case and try to figure it out as they go. Unfortunately, and you're not going to know as the person who's hiring the attorney. You're like, oh, well, it's a lawyer. I'm sure he knows what he's doing. But they may never have done a registry petition, but this is a very sophisticated, complex thing, in my opinion. And
look, man, I can see there on your wall, I can see your degree back there. You're a lawyer. You know everything about all law everywhere. Like, right?
Well, I just think that
a little facetious words.
I'm being very tongue in cheek on that one.
We stress all the time on this program about having an attorney. It's like, man, the stakes are so high on this, and you don't want to do it because there's a wait. What's the wait time after you file it pro se and botch it up? And how long do you have to wait before you can file another one?
It's in Georgia, it's 2 years, but it's more than that. In my opinion, like the hidden thing that people don't think about, like judges are human beings too. And like human beings are just a certain way. And like I try to explain to people, there's what's called a confirmation bias. And what that is like in people's minds, like your mind is predisposed to confirming whatever you already thought. Like once an idea gets into your brain, your mind, it does all types of cartwheels and gymnastics. Even when presented with new evidence, your mind wants to believe what it already thought the first time once it gets set in there. And so if you have a judge who heard your case, you did it yourself pro se, but you screwed it up. You didn't know what to present. You didn't know how to present it and you messed it up. Then you go out and get a lawyer. And then you go back in front of the same judge, or maybe it's a different judge, but the judge, even if it's a different judge, they can see, for example, that this petition was filed before, it got denied before, and the judge is just looking at it like, well, what's new now? What's different now? I think I should just deny it again. It was wrong before, I should deny it again. And so that's the problem with just kind of just throwing your petition in there, because a lot of judges, they're just going to want to confirm what they did the first time, which is to deny you again, if that makes sense.
Right. Oh, it totally makes sense to me, Larry. I'm assuming it makes sense to you.
It absolutely makes sense to me because I tell people you may, since you do not know the rules in this arena, there may be evidence that the judge considers that an attorney would have prevented the judge from considering by objecting. And of course, sometimes you have to play the reason for the objection and you have to argue the objection and the judge says, oh, well, I'll disregard that. But lots of times with the attorney, you can preclude that from coming in from the beginning because the attorney knows what to tell the prosecutor who's the adversary in this proceeding. And they can pre-agree on a lot of stuff. You can't do that because the prosecutor is not going to talk to you.
If I'm being honest about it, like I have some of my colleagues, I have very prestigious colleagues in Atlanta, prestigious in criminal law, who've been around, they've been practicing like 30 years. They bill at like $450 an hour and they make very good money doing criminal law. They would not be able to make heads or tails of the petition if they had to file it. I say 9 criminal law attorneys out of 10 are not equipped to deal with this. And the problem is a lot of people, especially in a small town, you somewhere like, let's, you know, you're in Macon, you're in Savannah. A lot of people, they'll just ask their cousin, hey, you know any criminal lawyers? Or they know a guy who's like a big criminal lawyer in town and they just go with what they know. But that person is not dealing with registry petitions and they're not equipped to deal with this. And so that's a big problem. But you don't know that as the consumer, as someone who is trying to get a lawyer to represent you in a petition. You just know, oh, he's a lawyer. I'm sure he knows. But a lot of people, lawyers don't know, but they'll act like they know. And you're not going to know the difference. Like he's screwing. Just like if you're not a mechanic, you're not really going to know that your mechanic is screwing up your car. Not really. Right. You don't know what they're doing. You just hope that you're giving this person the money and they're going to fix it. For all you know, maybe
you know when your tire falls off 2 weeks while you're 80 miles an hour down the interstate, you'll know for sure then.
I'm just saying, you're just not equipped to make that evaluation. And so just some friendly advice. If you're going to look for a lawyer to get you off the registry, at the bare minimum, what I would do is look on their website and see if they have a section on there for registry petitions. If a lawyer is advertising for like sex offenders and registry petitions, they're more likely than not, they handle those at least somewhat regularly and they can help you. Whereas, but most people, what they're doing is they're hiring just any kind of general criminal lawyer. They don't have anything on their website about registry petitions. That to me is a clue that they're probably not dealing with this regularly enough that they can help you.
I completely understand. All right, but now that you've explained the risks of going at it alone and all the other things that we've talked about before, the Registry Matters Alliance folks that listen to this program, like, can we talk about, I don't necessarily want to like ask you what your fee is, but what would the fee be roughly in general? And since Georgia has 159 counties, it seemed likely that your fee would be adjusted for travel and miscellaneous other expenses, et cetera. Can we dig into that?
I'll just put it out there. So like in Georgia, like I'll charge $5,000 for a registry petition, which is very low. Like for the level of experience that I have and for the work that I'm putting into it, it really is at least a $10,000 thing. But I like helping people. Like I used to be a public defender. I guess I'm still trying to save the world or whatever. So sure. I recognize that as a class, the sex offenders don't have money. It's like I said before, it's already hard enough to get a job as a convicted felon. Now you're a sex offender on top of that. Like I had a client, he used to be a teacher. He had a bachelor's degree and everything. Then he became a sex offender. Now he got he makes a living by, he goes to like junkyards and like picks up scrap and stuff and tries to sell it on eBay or something like that. And he makes probably like $700 a month or something crazy. Like that's doing the best that he could do. So it's like, it took everything for his family to be able to afford even that reduced rate of $5,000. Like a lot of people don't have it. Your average American, they say, you know, they probably have like less than $1,000 in their bank account in general, like 60% of Americans. So like you're talking about a sex offender,
right?
Where are they supposed to get the $5,000 from? And a lot of people have meritorious cases and they really could get off, but they don't have the money. And, you know, so I do what I can on my end. Like I reduce my fee. I don't charge people like $10,000 for that. I'll do it for $5,000, which is really like doing it for, it's really like $47.50 in terms of money that goes to me, because $250 of that goes to the filing fees just to file it in court. So, yeah, like it's.
I didn't even think about that part.
Well, I have to think about it because I have to do it. So it's like you're basically filing a lawsuit against the state of Georgia. Just to file that in court is going to cost you like $250. So it's really like $4,750 in terms of money to me. But I just let it go because it's like it's a very life-changing thing and that I like to do. It's not even the registry petition that I do, like that's not even 10% of like my firm's gross income. So like I make a lot more money doing other things. I just like to help people, so that's why I do it. That being said, I've come to the conclusion that I can't work for free because like I'm in my office now, I'll be out on the street and like they don't want to hear and be like, hey, I know the rent's due this month, but do you know with sex offender and like I got him off the registry and now he's like living wonderful and married with kids and all this stuff. So is it okay if I don't pay the $1,500 for my commercial lease? Is that okay? And they're going to look at me like I'm crazy. And that's reality.
Completely.
I can't do it for free. I just can't. Now, maybe one day, you know, because like I said, I do half criminal, half civil. Maybe one day, like, you know, I have some multi-million dollar cases that settle and then it's like, okay, I have a lot of money so I can afford to just work for free. But that's not my situation right now. My situation is I make a very good living, but I can't afford to work for free. So unfortunately, you can't help everybody. I just do what I can where I can.
Completely. Larry, is there anything else that you want to cover before we let Mr. Thomas go?
You've done a splendid job. I would just like to get his contact information out there for the hundreds and hundreds of people that are listening, will be listening to this.
Sure. So I don't know if you have a graphic up or what, but my website is brandonthomaslaw.com. So that's BRANDONTHOMASLAW.com. My office number is 678-330-2909. That's 678-330-2909. And my email is brandon@brandonthomaslaw.com. So you can do any of those. And I suppose you can even contact Andy or Larry, and then they can pass it along to me. But again, I'm licensed in Georgia. I practice in Georgia. And so there's going to be little to nothing that I can offer you if you're in California, for example. The only thing that I could probably help you with is if you're in another state and you think you want to move to Georgia and you're trying to get off the registry in Georgia because maybe they don't have a way to get off in your state. That's pretty much all I can help you with is if you're moving here. But if you're in another state, all I can really tell you is you need to try to find a person who handles registry petitions in your state.
So, well, I'd like to do a plug for Brandon. I've referred a case to him, and in 3 days, he turned the case around and did a felony resolution in Cobb County, Georgia, with a splendid outcome where the person will have no felony conviction if they do what they're supposed to do. So I can personally attest to his effectiveness.
Well, thank you, Larry. That's so nice of you. Glad we could help.
So, it was literally about a 3-day turnaround, wasn't it?
I mean, she needed it. Unfortunately, when you're a public defender, it's like that, but I still do that in my regular practice where it's like, it's almost like you're like triage and it's like an emergency room and somebody comes in, they need something immediately or they're going to die. And like that particular person had a warrant for her arrest. And like, if we did not resolve the case, she could have been in jail for weeks waiting just to go to court for the first time, but we resolved it in a way that she didn't even have to get locked up. And if she does everything right, she doesn't have to even have it on her record. So, you know, that worked out. So, but thank you.
Really, really, really appreciate you stepping in there like that. And we appreciate you being here with us.
Sure. Today. Well, thanks for having me.
Totally. Thank you so much for coming on, and I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks again.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. And I'm going to stop recording this. Thanks, Mr. Thomas. Appreciate it.
I'm not going to die, but it's not, I mean, it's, so the most, yeah, I did forget, the most important thing I wanted to say, which I should have said, is that, this year in Georgia, there was a bill to change the registry laws so that people would have to wait a minimum of 10 years before applying to get off the registry. And the reason is because people are thinking that, oh, it's too easy to get off the registry in Georgia. We want to make it harder. So I would encourage you to, if you're thinking about getting off the registry, you need to go ahead and try to make that happen now, before something bad happens. It just so happens that that bill that they tried to pass failed. It failed this time. It may not fail the next time. So, and there may be, for all I know, there's a movement across the country to use sex offenders as a political hot potato. And it's gonna be very difficult for a candidate to, if we're being honest, to take up the mantle for sex offenders. Because nobody wants to be the candidate that's easy on sex offenders. So it's really an easy target. And so I'm just saying in Georgia, we narrowly missed having a new law that would have made it very difficult for a lot of people to get off the registry. So if you think about getting off, you need to try to make that happen now before they change the law. And that's it. That's all I'm saying.
I appreciate you coming back on to add that on there. Perfect.
I no problem.
Perfect, though. Appreciate it. Bye. That's kind of funny. All right. Well, then I think we got to close this out really, really soon. We're bumping up. Do you want to do the Times Recorder thing from Ohio, or are we going to bump that also?
Let's do that next week. And,
okay,
and
cool.
Let's get on to the closing out with our wonderful mystery speaker.
Absolutely. So last week, I played this.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
And if you were paying attention watching on YouTube, then you would notice that I used a picture of who, Larry?
That's me, Richard Milhouse Nixon.
That's you.
The 37th president of the United States, who served from January 20th, 1969 through August 8th at noon, 1974.
And no one, Larry, wrote in. And I have a hard time believing that that is because nobody knew it. I have a hard time with that one, but maybe just nobody felt like writing. I don't know. Out of the thousands of people that listen to this program, I would have thought somebody would have written in and said that was Nixon. But alas, they did not. But now, so for this week, do you think that we need anything other than the individual? I think this one is kind of obscure. I can't say that I recognize this individual's voice just right out of the gate.
So, well, I can tell you that it's in that era a little bit earlier. It's in the 10 years leading up to that era that I just described. So tell us who said this.
Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Do I need to play that again too, Larry? You had me replay it last week.
So, well, I don't know. That voice is kind of old, but...
It is old. So one more time.
Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
All right, there you go. So write into registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And give me something in the subject line says, like, who's that speaker, WTS, something like that, so I can sort of search for them easily. And do that before next Saturday afternoon or something like that so that I have time to pick it out. And you can be a winner. Winner, winner, winner. Winner chicken digging. And with that, Larry, so we got some new patrons. The new patron, we already covered it from the question that was asked. Thank you, Liz, so very much. And then we had some transcript subscribers. Larry, why don't you read those off? Please, sir.
We have Donald and David and Lester. David is in military prison. Lester is a guest of the Bureau of Prisons. And Donald is actually in the free world. And it's always great to have someone in the free world. It could be that he prefers to read paper copies, or maybe he's not allowed to have internet access. But thank you to all of you.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. With that, Larry, I think we should close things out because we are pushing the limit of the transcript. And otherwise, you should go over to registrymatters.co to pick up all the links to everything that's going to be talked about in the next 30 seconds. And so registrymatters.co, voicemail is 747-227-4477. I will say that slower, 747-227-4477. Larry, do you remember like on episode 5 or something like that, someone wrote in and said, I don't understand what you said. Could you repeat the phone number? And I'm thinking, Larry, why didn't you just press rewind and play it again? That was what I was thinking at the time.
I think there is that provision.
And then email again is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And because we're all about the Benjamins, please feel free to go over to patreon.com/registrymatters. That's patreon.com/registrymatters and support the program. It is greatly appreciated. It is mostly a charity thing that I admit that's not right the right way to word it, but it is not, we're not doing this for money, that is for damn sure, but it does offset the time a little bit, and I appreciate every one of you so very much, and I thank you all very much. Anything else, Larry, before we get out of here?
And next week we're going to cover a case that we didn't have time for tonight out of Connecticut, an awesome win, and we're going to have a special guest that's going to be talking about an amazing topic about entrapment, so be tuning in next week.
Perfect. Sounds very good, sir. As always, Larry, I appreciate your time very much and all of your insight and setting everything up and all that. And I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Good night, Larry.
You've been listening to FYP.